I don't know if you can hear me. Yeah, good. Okay. Well, thanks everyone for being here. And I just want to firstly acknowledge that we're giving this talk on the unceded Coast Salish territories of the Tsleil-Waututh, Musqueam, and Squamish nations. And I'd like to thank Kate and Michael for allowing us to do this, or inviting us to do this talk. And I want to thank River for agreeing to do this together. So I'm going to be looking at my papers because I can't memorize this. So please, if you can't hear me, just shout out, actually. Unmute yourself and shout out. And I'll try not to rustle my papers too much. In this presentation, we're going to introduce ourselves in the context of the topic that we were learning, that we're discussing. We'll situate how Unpacking the White Leadership course came to be. We'll talk about why and how we came to take the course, our reflections on it, and what was most pertinent to us personally and perhaps to our Sangha. Then we'll touch upon where, as a Sangha, we might go from here. And first, so now I'll introduce myself. My name is Caro, and I'm a lesbian white woman who grew up in a white middle-class family and neighborhood in London, England. And I'm a settler here since 1993, living on Coast Salish territories. And I was granted my permanent residency according to the rules and regulations of other white settlers. My education in elementary school, both in attendance and in the attendees and content, was mainly white and Eurocentric. My high school education was more ethnically diverse because there was a wider catchment area. But it was also mostly white and Eurocentric in content. And my art training in Wales was similar, and my art therapy training in BC, again, were predominantly white in attendees and white and Eurocentric in content. So I was born into a racist society and educated in systems that upheld white privilege. I, like every other white middle-class person, benefited from white supremacy and was inducted in racism. Whiteness and middle-class privilege have afforded me easy access to education and employment, and part and parcel of this was consciously or unconsciously having a sense of entitlement. I'll give you an example. When I was in high school, age 11, I have a memory of the principal addressing the whole school and talking about her working hard was so important to get a satisfying, meaningful job. And I remember distinctly having the sense that these words did not apply to me. I would have a satisfying job anyway. And this came from the assumption that my parents were professionals and I would be too. And I think about how every aspect of my life has been affected by my privilege. And now I'll hand over to River for his intro. Sorry, River.
Thanks, Caro. hi, sweet folks. For those who don't know me, I'm River. I'd like to start by echoing Caro's words, thanking Kate and Michael for making space for us to have this conversation today. And to thank Caro as well for agreeing to do this as a co-talk. This is a scary topic, for me at least. And it's so much easier to talk about with the support of a good Dharma friend. So thanks to Caro. And thanks, folks, for showing up and for listening with an open heart. This is heavy stuff, so please take good care of your hearts during and after this this talk. To situate myself in this conversation, I'm white, super, super white. Like, I don't tan, I just burn. I'm the descendant of Irish and French settlers on this land. My mother's family settled in Jajage, known as Montreal, which is the ancestral territory of the Kanyenkehaga Nation, known as the Mohawk, part of the Iroquois Confederacy. My father was raised in St. Boniface, Manitoba, very close to the final resting place of Louis Riel. I remember as a child visiting my grandmother in the neighborhood, and I would ride my bike to St. Boniface Cathedral, and I would sit very close to the tomb of Louis Riel because there was good shade to read my book. And if anyone spent a summer in Winnipeg, it is dangerously hot in Winnipeg. So good shade is very precious. But I remember that because the significance of that place and its history was totally lost on me. I had never learned about it, despite my family having grown up and having settled in that area. So just the gulf in knowledge is really profound, thinking back now, knowing what I know. I grew up in Mokinstis, called Calgary, which is on Treaty 7 territory, and those are the lands of the Niitsitapi people, the Blackfoot Confederacy. So the story of my family in Canada is interwoven with the larger story of the dispossession, displacement, and deaths of many Indigenous peoples. My parents were working class, and my mom was a secretary and then went to night school to get herself through undergrad and then law school. And my father sold his plasma and worked at a gas station. And this story has been a source of great pride for my family. And I'm still so proud of my parents, but I recognize now that doors were available to them, doors were open to them that would not have been available to Métis boys in my dad's neighborhood in St. Boniface, or women of color in Montreal, where my mom grew up, that there were invisible barriers and divisions that weren't part of that narrative, that story of success. In my work as a lawyer, I often serve women of color. And yet I'm also part of, and in many respects a representative of, a legal system that has harmed and continues to harm them. And this is a place of tension in my practice. I identify as genderqueer non-binary, which for me means that I identify as neither a man nor a woman. And that's why I use they, them pronouns. I'm also bisexual, meaning I'm attracted to more than one gender. And I share this because being queer and bisexual has sometimes given me insight into the way that difference can be punished in our communities, and how assumptions about people are often based in the perspective and experience of those who occupy positions of privilege. But as I'll talk about a little later, that hasn't given me any special insight into the experience of other people. And so when I come to this discussion, and when we come to this discussion, there's something important to learn and discover, no matter where we're coming from or what our life experience has been. So just a word about the course. For those who may not be familiar with them, Branching Streams is a network of Dharma centers and sanghas with ties to San Francisco Zen Center, which is connected to Mountain Rain through our founding teacher, Soketsu Norman Fisher. Who was an abbot of San Francisco Zen Center and a student of Sojourn Mel Weitzman, who was himself a student of Shunryu Suzuki Roshi, the author of Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, which we can never keep in stock at the library. And he was also the Japanese priest who brought this particular style of Zen practice to California in 1959. So this course was offered by Branching Streams and was organized out of an awareness that we are experiencing a moment when white people are becoming more aware of the terrible impact of racial inequality in our communities. In the States, and this was largely an American course, we've seen large demonstrations arising from the murders of George Floyd, Ahmaud Arbery, and Breonna Taylor. And the pandemic has also thrown into sharp relief. We're seeing that some lives in our society are better supported and cared for and protected, and that the differences between these lives cut along racial and socioeconomic and gendered lines. And so Branching Streams asked the question, how can Dharma practitioners, and in particular, Dharma practitioners who are part of organizing and facilitating Dharma centers and sanghas, how they might use the energy of this time to confront and address the suffering of racial injustice and move towards greater inclusiveness and racial equity in our sanghas. And the response was this course, which was offered online. It was made up of 6 2-hour sessions through the summer into the fall, into the early fall. And that was kind of one of the great benefits of, one of the gifts of COVID was the fact that we were able to have this course and convene a really broad cross-section of North American sanghas. So folks from the East and the West Coast and the US and some folks from Canada, folks from Calgary Zoto Zen showed up and I think gave a similar talk in their community, and Michael and Kate were there, and Eden was there. So it was just, it was quite sweet. During a time when I felt quite disconnected from folks because we were all sort of stuck in our little hermitages, it was a really great opportunity to kind of travel by Zoom. So I'll hand it over to Caro to tell us why she took on the course.
The reason I took on the course was because, anti-racism has always been something that has been important to me, along with other issues of equality, issues of gender equality, particularly perhaps. And as a lesbian, I think it's kind of part and parcel of thinking about equality, I feel. But racism was always something that I cared about. I cared about anti-racism. My efforts to understand racism and white supremacy have mainly been through reading and listening to Indigenous, Black, people of color, writers and artists. And in very small ways, I've tried to address racism within systems I've been a part of or within movements for that purpose, like the anti-apartheid movement. When I was at art school, like I said, it was dominated by white male teachers. So a little group of us got together with the student union and we put money towards funding, having presenters, artists, people of color and queer people to come and talk, give presentations of their art. And we advocated to have the next artist in residence be a person of color, and that happened. But these little ways, these little efforts have been inconsistent and feel vastly insufficient. In other ways in my life, like as an art therapist or as an art teacher, I've tried to be aware of cultural diversity and I've tried to include the materials and invite in speakers have people give workshops and share their own knowledge. But still, now, understandably and rightfully, there's more of a focus on white people educating themselves and looking at their own racialization and participation in upholding white supremacy. So I was really fortunate enough to have just literally joined the Council of Mountain Rain, and this came up the same day, I think, and I jumped at it because I really wanted the opportunity to learn more and to work on my own issues more. So I wanted to be part of helping make the Sangha also a place that was more inclusive and diverse in its membership. I think when I first joined Mountain Rain, I was aware that this was mainly a white group, and I felt some discomfort with this. And I've since felt a similar discomfort with some aspects that reflect this that I've not always been able to articulate. And the course kind of supplied the language for me to do that, and a framework that makes increasing diversity look like a possibility. It gave us that framework to work with. Yeah, and then it's over to you again, River, I think.
Thanks, Carol. Oh, that was so beautifully put. What sort of spurred me to take the course? And I was sort of thinking as I was preparing for the talk, I was kind of lucky. Michael gave a sort of a talk about vow during one of the evenings during our Lynn Lake Sesshin, and asked us to consider what vows we hold, what are our deepest aspirations, our deepest intentions. And that was really helpful for me in framing what exactly spurred me to take this class. I think a major vow for me, and this sort of came up even during the talk, I thought, yeah, this is my aspiration, is to make the Buddha Dharma, and Zazen specifically, available to anybody who would like it, anyone who feels that it would be a benefit to them. And I want Black, Indigenous, and people of color to feel welcome and supported in our Sangha for that reason. I want Mountain Rain to be a place of rest, healing, and connection for everybody, and especially for folks who find rest, kindness, and connection harder to come by in our society. So that was really helpful to sort of frame it in that way. A personal experience that kind of drives this intention or this vow is that a beloved Dharma friend, who is a person of color, has confided in me on more than one occasion that they have felt ill at ease or excluded when practicing in mostly white Dharma communities. I'm sharing this now with their consent. The events that they described when they were relating this to me were not capital R racist acts. There were no tiki torches, no Confederate flags, no red ball caps. But they were comments about my friend's hair, their clothes, the way they spoke. Often they were well-intentioned. But these interactions left my friend feeling like an outsider, and they added this extra layer of exhaustion that I could really see. And our practice is already quite difficult, even without added complications. My friend also articulated something a little bit more insidious, and that was this, and Caro sort of alluded to this, these assumptions, these norms about how Sangha folks should talk, act, relate to one another, and take on the work of community. Priorities around what issues and topics are worthy of discussion in Sangha, and how these issues should be discussed. These assumptions are for the most part unspoken, and they arise from a white, educated, upper middle class, for the most part, patriarchal background. Nobody sat down and said, this is how we should divide up tasks in Sangha, or speak about our practice, or this is how we should dress. Much of this was unconscious, unexamined, and reflexive. Often these norms for folks who are privileged, like myself, can feel like a neutral, safe territory, like the default. The problem is that part of the world, the part of the perspective that is shared here, happens to be that of a white heterosexual man. And the closer you might be to that, the more neutral that's going to feel. So, for example, a common norm that comes up is that politics or social causes should remain outside the Zendo, that the Sangha should focus on Zen topics only. For the people whose lives are directly impacted by social causes, say police brutality or land theft, it might feel like they have to leave a part of their identity at the Zendo door. So when my friends shared their experiences with me, it was very difficult for me to hear. First, because I really, really love Dharma communities, and I feel like we're at our best when we're practicing together. But I was also caught off guard, because at the time, I was mostly blind to my friend's experience. It was as if we were living in two totally different worlds, which is sort of true. In the sense that I experienced the world with eyes and ears conditioned by the causes and conditions of my birth as a white settler on colonized land. Many of the norms of white Zen communities, though not all, feel comfortable to me. They feel like my neutral. So although I'm relating my experience with this friend, I've actually had a few experiences like this where my privilege meant that I was having a great time and I felt really cozy when a friend might not have felt as welcome. In this case, even when my friend gifted me with an awareness of her discomfort, I didn't really know how to respond, apart from love and listening. I watched my friend attend less and less often, saw their discomfort more clearly. But apart from offering my loving presence and support, which isn't nothing, I felt unequipped to create a Dharma community that could be a true place of rest and welcome for my friend. When my friend did show up, and often they related to me the courage and commitment that took showing up, I could tell that the radiance of their presence and sharing was dimmed just a little. Of course, it's a privilege for me to have even been told about this. My friend trusted me enough to confide in me, which must have taken great courage and love and trust. I wonder how often people of color come to Zen communities and slowly, almost imperceptibly, fade into the background and drift away. I may not notice until I realize that I'm surrounded by other white upper middle class people. So this is why I felt a real pull to engage in the class. And not just that, I really feel it's important for me to engage with these issues in a manner that harmonizes with the ways that I've been invited to understand my life as a disciple of Buddha and a student of Zen. So I really appreciated that in this course, we were taking up and examining these questions of racism and white supremacy through a lens of practice firmly anchored in Buddhist teachings and ethics. And what was really encouraging for me was to see that unfolding conversations of racial equity and inclusivity in the context of Dharma practice felt like a real extension of both of those activities. The Dharma is enriched by these conversations and tools, and these conversations in turn, I think, are enriched by bringing an eye of the Dharma to them. So I'm going to pass the ball back to Caro to talk a little bit about how the course was for her.
Would help. Yeah, something that struck me at the right the way through the course was how well the course was presented by Crystal, the presenter. She created a really safe space for everyone to learn, share, and make mistakes and practice together. She had excellent equanimity, and yet did not hesitate to call people in if they were. If they were perpetuating any form of oppression, she wouldn't hesitate to call them in, but she did it in such a kind and calm way. And I use this term calling in. It reflects the ambience of the course, because the purpose of the course wasn't to shame or blame people, but rather to work together to dismantle white supremacy with the understanding that we're all born into a racist structure. And though we did not choose this, we do have a responsibility to change it, to address it. We were given articles each week to read, a really great resource list, and we hope to share that with everyone. And it was pretty much focused on US content, so the people who've taken the course are starting to collect a Canadian resource list, which we also hope to share. The articles began with looking at how and why the concept of race was constructed, despite the fact that biologically there's no such thing as different races among human beings. Russell. And we were given the many useful tools, like we were given guidelines how to participate and agreements for multicultural interactions. And we had breakout rooms where we would have a cohort of 5 or 6 people who remained constant throughout the course and whom we could discuss our responses to of the course and practice some of the skills we were learning. And many people, including myself, felt that we got quite comfortable with that group and felt quite close to them, despite the fact that we had very different levels of awareness. Some people, this material was really new for them, and some were well-versed, but there didn't seem to be like a judgmental atmosphere or anything. So I found some of the course looked at personal, interpersonal, systemic, and structural racism. And like I say, I found it interesting to learn how the term white evolved, initially excluding many ethnicities like Italian, Jewish, Irish, until it became apparent that rebellion by non-whites against the elites would occur if those ethnicities were not given some of the privilege. I learned a lot from one of the books on the resource list, An Indigenous People's History of the United States by Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz. And she debunked the myth of the land being nothing but wilderness and described the complex farming and governing systems already in place before colonization. She also went on to detail the strategies of genocide, relocation, and removal of each nation of indigenous people, and also the resistance and resilience against all odds. I found myself being once again shocked by learning these things. Even though I think I know these things, certain things that really shocked me was the laws that were created, like in 1823, the Supreme Court ruling was made that gave white people a right to anything they could take in terms of land or anything. They had the right to do that. Another rule was that white people would not be punished for killing an indigenous person. And I think perhaps it's my racial comfort that allows me to be shocked in this way, rather than think, yep, that's the way it is. And one of the topics that I felt were particularly relevant for me was white fragility. How white people, not having to deal with racial stress in our daily lives, develop racial comfort, and therefore are fragile in our tolerance to racial stress, and this triggers defensiveness. A few of us on the course commented on how easy it is for us white people to not think about issues of race and oppression. And it takes mindfulness and effort to keep our attention on these efforts, on these issues. Verna Meyer writes, "We receive constant messages that whiteness is valuable, and we're used to feeling a sense of belonging in most spaces. All of this leads to a huge sense of entitlement to being not only comfortable, but correct at all times." I think as a lesbian, I do recognize not feeling a sense of belonging in heterosexual normative situations, but in white spaces for sure, I'm comfortable. For example, when I settled in Canada as a white immigrant, it was very easy for me. I did not feel, nor was I made to feel, like an outsider. Another topic was how we defend the good white self. And I found this really relevant too, because we don't want to be racist and we don't want to be thought of as racist. But in some ways that we're often not aware of, we are racist, of course, and sometimes by trying not to, we can actually make matters worse or perpetuate oppression. Many examples were offered, more obvious ones to more subtle ones, and I confess that I've definitely enacted some of these. One of the ones was called rushing in with whiteness, offering solutions, approaches that make sense to us because we just think that we know best, and otherwise known as dysfunctional rescuing. I think I've been guilty of that from time to time, not only with race, but with other class, with other things too. Minimizing difference, wanting to be anti-racist without giving up any privileges. In interpersonal situations, things like withdrawing from interacting, or if a racial argument comes up, like withdrawing, perhaps because you feel like you don't have the skills or the language to do it, so you don't want to risk being shown up. I think I felt like that from time to time. Or equating discomfort or distress with lack of safety was another one they mentioned. So I think it'd be really interesting to take time as a Sangha to look at these things, sit with them mindfully, see where they land with us, and discuss them in groups, as we did on the course. The last one that I'm going to talk about that I found particularly relevant to myself and perhaps to our Sangha is white cultural norms, as River was mentioning. And this is what I was referring to and found it hard to articulate. In the article, What Makes a Group White, from a blog called Decentering Whiteness, the question they posed when considering groups was, what is the set of cultural norms in operation? If they are white cultural norms, then it's a white group. Since white people invariably resort to white normative structure, any group containing all or mostly white people is a white group, whether the members consciously claim to be so or not. The article goes on to say that to be color conscious, at a minimum, the group needs to understand that it has functioning within a white normative framework and bring that framework into conscious consideration and discussions. It might not look as a sangha, we're perpetuating white cultural norms as we are following a tradition from Japan, China, and India. My understanding is that what needs examining is whether we operate, communicate, organize within a white normative structure, and if we are aware of our own racialization and privilege and how this is acknowledged. I think it'd be really interesting and important and liberating to look deeply at this and really unpack it. So what are white cultural norms? One example is meritocracy, the belief that we have an even playing field. If you just work hard enough, you will succeed. And this makes me think of that high school memory that I had of, you know, just assuming that I would be okay, that I would be okay, and just imagining the difference for someone who's internalized the media and perhaps the educational system that was, discriminated against them because of their culture or because of outright racism, and just how that would set them up for success. The other one, so they did ask us to pick a couple of these that related to the Sangha, and River goes in more detail about this. It was hard to pick because I think, you know, in many ways, the Sangha is really trying to be inclusive, and we always have room for improvement. And so, some of the ones I picked were, I'm not sure where I put that. Okay, sorry. Paternalism, where decision making is clear to those in power and unclear to those without. I chose this because it took me a long time to know about the function of the council and the practice committee, and perhaps that might be the same for others. I don't know. There's many other ones, and River will touch upon them. For me, this is kind of the crux of the work I'm interested in doing in any group I belong to, and I'm delighted that our Sangha is open to this kind of work. I feel it's a process that's essential to creating an environment that invites diversity. And another thing I learned that fits well with the parameter of patience is that this will take time. It's not going to happen overnight. We were given an article on white supremacy culture, and I really like this quote as one of many suggested ways to counter that culture. Name defensiveness as an issue and explore how it impedes the mission. Where did I put that next one? hang on a minute. Sorry. Understand the link between defensiveness and fear. Think of building community as an antidote to fear. So in the name of community, we're just going to take like a few minutes before I hand it back to River to just sit for 3 minutes and think about what is your comfort level on discussing issues of race. I know that, you know, for me, that there has been lots of discomfort. What are your defenses? What are your fears? And I'll be the timer, and I'll just I'll ding it again in 3 minutes. over to you.
Thanks, Carol. So, as Carol mentioned, this list of white norms and characteristics of white supremacy was also a resource that I found really helpful and challenging. And it's really interesting. Last week, I attended a training on reconciliation through my work. And this list came up again, was offered as a resource there. And sort of sweet to see it. And we'll share what I'll do right now, actually, before I forget, because I have a tendency to forget these things, is I'll just share a link in the chat to a Google Doc. And that is just a short list of the resources that Carol and I have mentioned this morning in our talk, so you can investigate and look through them yourselves. And I'll just touch on one that I found really resonated with me. So as Carol mentioned, these characteristics are used as norms and standards without being proactively named or chosen by a community. And in many cases, we aren't even aware that these behaviors or expectations are at play, which is sort of like ancient twisted karma. What was wonderful for me about this list is that each characteristic offered an antidote, which was sort of like a positive norm that one can practice with. And that felt very Buddhist to me. You know, lists are, as Kate and Michael have said many times, lists are kind of a trademark element of Buddhist teaching. And often there's another side, something positive that we can carry in our practice. And that's something I've found personally really helpful in my practice and my life. So, for example, one characteristic of white supremacy listed is perfectionism. And the authors, Okun and Jones, who worked on this list, described this as a focus on inadequacy and shortcomings, both our own and those of others, rather than what we're doing right. Mistakes are seen as personal, saying something about the person, rather than seeing them for what they are, just, you know, mistakes. Maybe something to apologize for, to own up for, and to acknowledge. And actually, we did some beautiful exercises during this course on apology. But certainly not a mark on the soul to be carried forever, or an indication that someone is lesser. And of course, the mistakes of folks with less privilege are often accentuated in communities. They're remembered more, personalized to a greater degree. I think about how in the aftermath of a police killing, or harming a Black or Indigenous person, the media will dig through this person's past and find their mistakes as some means of diminishing the harm done. He had a criminal record. He had an addiction issue. He was high. We found opiates in his blood. He shouldn't have been there. There was a warrant for his arrest. The list goes on. The antidote for perfectionism is developing a culture of appreciation. I love that. I really, really love that. A culture of appreciation where the organization takes time to make sure that people's work and efforts are appreciated, and to develop a culture of learning where everyone makes mistakes, and mistakes are opportunities to learn something. Mistakes are sometimes good. Sometimes that's, you know, the best thing that could have happened was a mistake. This really makes me think of Shunryu Suzuki's use of the phrase shoshaku jushaku, or one continuous mistake, in Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. Shohaku Okumura, who's a real gift to those of us trying to parse Dogen, thinks that Suzuki Roshi actually paraphrased this from Dogen's Shobogenzo Gyobutsu Igi, the dignified behavior of an action Buddha. And there Dogen states, stepping forward is a mistake. Stepping backward, also a mistake. Taking one step is a mistake. Two steps, mistake. Therefore, one mistake after another mistake. The way Suzuki Roshi reads this, and I really love this, is that there's no difference between an infinite series of mistakes and single-minded effort. They're one and the same thing. Giving up a culture of perfectionism, which often benefits me as a white person who gets to make more mistakes than someone who's a person of color. Someone who's read as male gets to make more mistakes than someone who's read as female. Giving that up is accepting my life as a series of continuous mistakes, of never being done learning, never being done growing, never being able to clap my hands and call it a day, as Caro said, to sort of say, job done. So a life of effort, in this case, a life of trying and falling short of my vow to heal the damage done by generations of white supremacy. In exchange is the opportunity to know that in the middle of my mistakes, in the middle of my falling short, I'm fine just the way I am. I'm loved, I'm okay, and I have a right to be here. And from that place, there arises the vow to extend that same safety and ease to every person with whom I practice. So a couple questions for reflection, if you'd like. And no need to do these. I just find them really helpful when others give me questions to chew on. Looking through these characteristics of white supremacy, are there norms or assumptions that you identify with? Either you see them and say, yeah, this has hurt me in the past, or I've used this, or I've benefited from this. And how does the corresponding antidote leave you? Is there a feeling of relief, a feeling of a weight being lifted? Or is it really confronting? And then I didn't quite have time to touch on this, but Caro mentioned we operated by a set of agreements developed by East Bay Meditation Center called the Agreements for Multicultural Interaction. And we've included those in the resources. And I'd really invite you to take a look through them and see, are there elements of these agreements that could be a place of rest or ease or healing in our Sangha or for yourself? Are there any that you think you might struggle with, would have difficulty with, and why would that be? And I'll pass it over to Caro for a couple of final words.
We just want to put it out there that we'd like to continue this work within the Sangha, and we'd like others to join us if they want to. And we talked in council about striking up a committee for inclusiveness. And perhaps it would mean, part of that would mean developing a similar course than the one that Crystal presented, but with Canadian context that would be for our Sangha and other Sanghas in Canada. But we'd wait till we get a committee to see which direction we took. So I'm going to, if I may, and if this is okay with everyone, in the chat, and if joining on the committee, can email me, and then we'll come up with a list and organize how to meet and carry on with this work. Thank you, everybody, for listening, and please call us in. if anything upset or offended you, and we are grateful for being here. Thank you.